Why had those others hauled? They were old and experienced boatsmen. One man in the quay at Boffin warned him, "Sharpen your knife, be ready for trouble, cut away your nets. Your crew is too young." Were they going home?
On Friday, the 28th of October, 1927, four boats rowed out from Rossadilisk and five from Inishbofin to catch mackerel and herring in Cleggan Bay off the Connemara coast. By the following morning, 25 fishermen from the area had drowned, leaving families heartbroken and destitute in a hurricane that claimed 45 lives along the western seaboard. Not so much a night to remember, rather a night never to be forgotten.
They left home about 5 o'clock in the evening to get their boats ready for the sea. So they get out there at 7 o'clock. Between 5:30 and 6 o'clock, and it was very calm, but it was making a little misty rain. But, you know, not bad. So the boat on the fishing ground, and the storm arose all suddenly, and it blew at 70 or 80 miles an hour, I guess. Which was on, but maybe about an hour, an hour and a half.
Some of them would have had their nets half out, others would have been just maybe in the middle of pulling other nets. So some of them would have cut their nets, and others were trying to hold on to them for anchors on that particular night. They had no warning. Now, a man called Dr. Holbrook in Cleggan Farm, he had a radio, so he had actually got the weather forecast. So when he had heard how bad it was going to be, he sent one of his farm labourers out called Tommy Mullen on a white horse to go to Rossadilisk and to warn them not to go out fishing. But at that stage, it was too late. They had already gone out.
Well, just about the time the sun had been setting, the sun shone for a few minutes. My father was in bed because he was in Cleggan out the night before on night fishing, and he was in Cleggan until about 2 that day, then selling the fish. He got his supper anyway, and if 10 or 15 minutes, another fella called to the door, and he says, "Mark," he says, "what do you think of it?" So he gave a look around him. He said, "I don't think much of it," he says, "but," he said, "it's this way," he said, "we might make a shot or so." So at that day, he turned in, took his eelskins, stuck them under his arm, lit his pipe, and that was that. He went. They went, the two of them.
They believed that you catch more herring at night, so they were at night. And it's said, like, the tradition in the area, which my father used in his book Rain and the Wind, was that they went fishing the previous night, and they had this extraordinary experience where they saw a ghost boat following them, you know. What happened was they were rowing along, and one particular boat, load of fellas, got ahead of the main group, and they looked behind them, and there was this ghost boat following them, you know. So they tried everything to get rid of this ghost boat, or to call out, say, "Is that you, Johnny, or is that you, Patsy?" Or they got no answer. So eventually, like as my father has written in his book, they blessed the boat, but the boat followed them for about a mile. So there was this warning given. Now, like, my father makes a story of it, but this was there was a warning given that there was going to be a storm. But they still went out the following night in these rowboats with just oars, and a hurricane struck, and it hit them full blast on. But the other element in it was the fact that, like, some of them who cut the nets were saved, those who didn't weren't, you know. And there's the most incredible description given by some of the survivors where they looked and moonlight suddenly appeared, and they saw a boat, you know, with all the men being turned right up by the waves. The waves were absolutely gigantic and turned right over, and they could see the men falling into sea. Like, one of the survivors told me that, you know, they saw things like that. You know, it's like the men, I've met men, say, who fought in World War One. They nearly can't talk about the experience, you know. And that's with the men of Cleggan, that the experience of going through this and of seeing men they knew, friends of theirs, drown in front of them, just knocked them out.
And my mother was making bread, you know, mixing, as we call it. And all of a sudden we heard the bang. So she shoved the dish from another to the floor, and she made a remark, which I never heard her making her that remark before, and often was bad nights out, you know, he was often bad nights out. She threw the dish from her, and she said, "Except the mercy of God," she said, "Daddy will never come in."
A storm began to march, the shrill wind piping and thunder exploding, as lightning flaked in willow cascades and bayonets of hail flashed over craters and hillocks of water. All the boats were trapped. None had reached the pier.
It got very dark out there. It was just like a whirlwind. I suppose in a sense it may have been like a type of hurricane. Most of them got lost actually within a mile of their own farms, within a mile, because they had small boats called curraghs and they would not have been able to venture out far. Now, by chance, my grandfather was swept ashore by a freak wave. Another man, which a lot of people would be probably familiar with through the poem of Richard Murphy, was Pat Concannon, who had come from Inishbuffin. He had struggled all through the night with his young crew, and he had arrived into Cleggan, I think it was 4 o'clock in the morning, with blinded by the sea and his hands four times the size that they were, trying to keep his crew together with letting in and out nets and keeping the boat head in the wind.
The minute the storm came on him, he cut his nets. He knew he had to get out of the area he was in, and he kind of ran ahead of the storm and kept the boat up or head up in the wind. And he made for his boat, his curragh that was anchored in Resigillus, but when he got there she was sunk. They thought all was lost in, but they kind of crash landed really on that strand down there, Salerna. His brother was lost, and his brother-in-law, and about five of his first cousins, so it had to be very severe, because it came from a straight line all the way north from Lachin right across Inishki, right across to Resigillus, basically in a straight line as you look down across Achill there. It had to be very, very severe, because they were shrewd fishermen. They were no fools. They were caught out in it.
Fishermen, if you talk to fishermen, you know, men who have fished all their lives on the sea, and particularly these men in the west coast of Ireland who were living in marginally and doing herring fishing and things like that, they didn't ever learn to swim. That's one of the things. Because they reckoned if the boat went down, they were better to drown and not be worrying about swimming. You know, so an awful lot of fishermen, the older fishermen, never learned to swim, which sounds ludicrous, you know. But I mean, what happened was when this hurricane struck them, they were gone, you know. Now, the men that survived, they were blinded. The man I met was totally blinded by the salt. You know, the salt blown into his eyes actually blinded him. He never saw again. The other men, had terrible wounds on their backs from the waves battering their backs. The man who was at the bow of the boat, was getting battered as they rowed for shore.
Then sickness surged, and against their will they were gripped with terror. He told them to bail. When they lost the bailer, they bailed with their boots. Then they cast overboard their costly nets and 1,000 mackerel.
Well, it had about 7 or 8 foot lifted off the sea, you know, the foam. When it hit us, we were the first boat it hit. We were the nearest to the Yale. And our nets broke away, and we worked on our anchor. You know, we dropped our anchor, and we worked on the anchor and the mooring. We had no nets. One of Pat, you brought your nets to Fahey, would you? They brought nets, mooring, boat, and all the way into the mouth of Letterfly.
We held on to our nets right along, and we had the four oars out and along with the nets all the time.
And what were you doing during the storm? You know, what were you rowing or
We were rowing,
taking the weight off the boat. Taking
the weight off the boat and off the nets for that break. Yeah.
Did you see any of the other boats?
We heard the boat. We were one of the drowning boats. It was about 50 yards east of us. We knew she was drowning too, you know, but we couldn't do no good to her.
Like, what did you see exactly?
We heard their roars. Because when the wave had washed over, we wouldn't hear nothing. And when she'd come up again, we'd hear them all together. That was on her about 3 or 4 minutes. And it mightn't be that at all. We were saying to be that much. Anyway, all of a sudden, everything died down. We knew there was a boat lost, but we didn't know who she was until the next day. That was Pat Poore's boat. Yeah.
Some of the Buffon boats, at least one of the Buffon boats, was in Letterfrack. And, you know, they knew Clunan's boat was gone right away, because he was found on Cleggan Beach. The rest of them, they were hoping, I suppose, for a couple of days afterwards, as you do in a tragedy, that someone ended end up on an island or washed ashore somewhere, but that was not to be the case. There was 8 found, and 9 were never found here in Resigillus. God knows where they are, but sure. They're somewhere out there, I suppose, in the bay, you know.
We drifted away from there, and we went out about 100 yards outside the Lionhead. I said, now there's another hurricane coming by, they said. And there's some sort of noise, I said behind me, I said, whatever it is. They all looked up now and they listened, and they heard the noise. What was it but a boat that was upset or mount and there's the last boat. That's
right.
The boat now that Martin is talking about.
It's only about 2 miles across
the
from current, where Tool was drowned.
The current took it out and straight from that, straight on Cligganhead. And the brother Cligganhead, that's for other than it's all the Cliggan it was, one lump. And in town it happened to come four of them, and didn't they get in hold of them. Our nets broke.
Yeah.
And we had to go to Bannockfield then.
My grandfather was the editor of the Connacht Tribune. So he was rung up on the night the disaster happened, and he went out there, and he was the first journalist there, and he reported on it and wrote the story of the Cliggan disaster. And this story, newspaper story, spread all over the world. It was published all over the world. My father then, as a young lad of 17 years old, went out there and visited the place and was, you know, really taken over by the way people were dominated by this terrible thing that happened. I mean, he was probably there in the early 30s, you know, in the early 30s, so it was 6 or 7 years after. And he kept this in his mind. There was one extraordinary thing that happened that hadn't ever been reported, and I wasn't able to do it because there was a survivor who lived north of Cleggan, and his story was an extraordinary one, which was never told, even in any of the newspaper reports or anything. What had happened to him was he managed to get the boat into the shore. He then climbed a cliff of 100 foot or something, went and got help and came back and got people to come up and bring these people up, you know. So when we went there with the television, I went and I wanted to get him, and the priest was bringing me to his house, and he came stamping out of the house past us, you see. And the priest followed him and he says, what's wrong? He says, when that journalist came here in 1928, he didn't talk to me. I'm not going to talk to this fella now in 1972. So So they lived with this tragedy, you know, and it hovered over the place, you know.
One of the crew said he heard his brother shouting for help 2 oars away. Yet when he hollered, there was no reply. In a lightning flash, a white hand rose and rested on the gunwale, then slowly sank.
I often heard him talking of a dream he had a couple of weeks before the disaster, that bad men raiding the village, and they were raiding the houses and stealing what little they had, and he woke up as they were coming into his house, and he started woke up roaring that they weren't going to take anything off him, you know. That's, I remember that, I'm talking about that story. It was some kind of a warning, you know, that maybe he'd be saved while the rest were lost, or something in that line, you know. But I think what saved him was that he caught in time. He always maintained that the rest of the fishermen tried to hold on to the last minute of their nets, because they were valuable. They were worth, I think, about £4 at that time, every net. So there'd be 5 nets on board, that'd be 20 quid, a lot of money in 1927. If their nets were gone, they couldn't fish, because they had no other way of replacing them.
When you know Connemara people and Arden Island people and everything, they're only a step away from paganism, is what I always think. Like, I always think the Tuatha De Danann are the antecedents of the Arden Islanders, you know. They have a pagan feel about them, you know. So they watch things like, you know, bees on the bushes and, you know, the leaves turning brown. And they looked at all those things before they went to sea each night, you know. And this ghost ship, the ghost boat that they had seen, was a significant sign, perhaps to get some of them not to go. But then again, they were thinking, like, the herring are running, we caught them last night, we have to go.
If they were on the water at 6 o'clock, they would have started, they would say the rosary. If they were setting their nets, they would set them in the name of the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit. They would have never have gone out without holy water, which would be kept in the stern of the boat. One of my grandfather's traditions at that time, he would have only ever made 33 pots, and that was for each year of orders on the earth. An old tradition then was also, if they met a lady with red hair, they felt that was a bad omen. There was no point in going out that day. they would have all had scafflers. Mainly, to be honest, all their tradition seem to have been around religion. And I'm sure, like that, there was loads of people with red hair, and I'm sure they met them, and they still went out fishing.
They were shrewd enough in their own way too with the weather. You know, they had other ways of knowing the weather. You know, but they didn't expect anything like what they got. They'd look to the clouds, and the seagulls kind of thing. Sometimes they'd be on land before a storm. You'd often see them, you know, grazing on the land. It used to be a sign. You'd hear them saying that there was a storm on the way.
Down the valleys of this lull, like a black cow in search of her calf, an upturned hull wallowed towards them. Her stem had parted. All hands must have been lost. She lunged to his side and almost staved him. Were the men inside?
We knew there were people waiting, because we saw lanterns and lights along the shore, you know what?
Oh, yes, and the car...
But then everything was... all hopes were given up when we landed. We landed and nobody felt it at all. About 2 o'clock in the morning. Never felt it, and we walked down here to the village.
The people had given up, they'd gone to
they
bed.
Had. And I tell the truth, I had my brother that was fishing with Pat.
Oh, he was? John Dotter?
He's living yet too, he's down in the mental home though. I believe he was well off to be. He's down there.
And you thought he was lost?
Oh, I was sure of it, and about the midday the next day they came from Letterfrack.
And did you walk into your own house, or where did you go?
Well, the first house I met on the way down there, it was his boat we had, you know, Michael Cunyan, he wasn't fishing at all.
Yeah.
That night he didn't go out, his wife wasn't feeling good, and we walked down, right straight down, and we walked in, and he wouldn't believe anyone born that were living people.
Yeah. They were all sure you were drunk.
Oh, they were all right. Tell the truth, it was a wicked night.
So it must be some of them tried to make the shore, but they didn't make it up for them. But there's one boat I say lost, must be lost on Litskish. The bodies was never found. The boat was found right off the shore. About 9 o'clock that night.
He had respect for the sea. He gave away a share of his catch at the Cleggan market. No one who asked for a feed of fish was refused.
Years and years ago, I went on holidays to the Aran Islands, and I asked this island man, I said, like, you know, why is it that everybody votes for Fianna Fáil in the Aran Islands? Because, like, there nearly wasn't a vote other than Fianna Fáil in the three Aran Islands. He said, Mr. Dev gave us the dole. See, previous to De Valera coming to power, there was no dole. So these people lived on this marginal land. They maybe had a cow, a pig and chickens, and they fished for herring. Now, what used to happen then was they'd bring the herring in, and the herring then would be brought to Clifton and into Galway, and they might get a pound a barrel for a barrel of herring, you know. So they were living on incredible poverty. It was incredible poverty. So that's why it made such an impact to lose so many men, able-bodied men, you know.
One-room cottage, there may have been windows broken on it, the thatch may have been leaking. The only way of heating at that time would have been an open fire. And basically sometimes, I suppose they would have had some livestock in. I suppose the only way they were able to survive was through the fishing, because when they went out fishing, on top of bringing in their catches and trying to sell them, they would have also kept stocks for their families as well to survive on over the winter time. They had a bartering system in every village, I suppose, in Ireland at the time, where one family helped another family at different times and seasons, in the line of if it was saving turf, saving hay, maybe doing work during the winter time on mending nets and pots and boats.
That's the way things were in them times. They were hardy men. They had to be to survive. They had big families to support. There was 10 of us, and we were not alone. I mean, they had to fish. They had to fish or starve. Of my family, the whole immediate family, the whole family immigrated by myself, and I went for a short while, and I didn't like England really, and I came back. But my father's brothers and sisters, after that, they all went to America, and they never came home. Some of the families, my own included now, that we got, were shifted up to this village, which is Salerna, from Rasigillisk, and the land we had in Rasigillisk was given to another Feeney family, And they done that type of work. So I suppose they tried their best. You can still see the ruins of several houses down there today. You know, there's just the walls left now, the stone walls and all the rest. It was a ghost town, really. I remember being in that village as a child. There was nobody in it. You know, there's, I think, two families I remember being in it when I was growing up. And in my father's time, there was 25 houses there. So from 25 to 2 was a big, big drop.
The very most it had would be, you know, sort of 10 acres of land. So they would have a cow on it, two cows maybe. They would have a cow for milk and a cow for, you know, for calving, so that they could sell the cow. They would have, there wasn't that many sheep in the Cleggan area, but they would have had their own vegetables. They would have had a pig as well, and chickens. They would be, so they were very self-reliant. They would have had a part of the bog, commonage of the bog. So they cut their own turf. They made their own bread. Like, with the fish, they cooked their fish. They would have had pig meat, which they salted. So that was the way they were totally self-sufficient. You know, and the other thing they had, of course, was the shop in Cleggan would have had an account, you know. So at the end of the 6 weeks or so, when the fish were sold, they would pay the account. The only education that all of them went to was the Bunscoil, you know. They finished at 12, 13, 14. Because they had to begin, they were working on the farm anyway. And so they definitely, they just did the, you know, the bare minimum of education. There was no, like, secondary schools in Connemara, virtually. Do you know what I mean? There might have been one in Clifton now. But, I mean, the average, like, in Uachtarard, when I was in Uachtarard in the 50s, there was no secondary school in Uachtarard. There is now. But so, therefore, for people to go to secondary school, the main way they did it was, in fact, one of the sons went to a diocesan college, went to board in a diocesan college, so he was going to become a priest. And many of them didn't, you know, because they were getting a secondary education. But secondary education just wasn't. At 14 you finished, you helped with your family, and usually you took the boat.
The funeral boats brought over the bodies found, but most were carried away on the great ebb tide. From the village of Rossadilisk they lost 16, and from Boffin 9. One man above all was blind.
Yeah, we got our brother all right. On the beach, yeah. Sank him over the water. My other brother seen it. He knew his hand was up, and the wave went off with his hand was up. He had his eye skins on him. He hadn't crossed the road no more. So he said, "This is my brother." He said, "I'm going to bring him in." The lad said, "No. You're not going out there, Tom, because it's too deep." So he wouldn't give in. So we'll make a chain. He said, "Every man catch one other." He said, "Their hands and..." Oh my God, he's going to catch your brother's hand. So that's how it was done, I pulled him ashore.
We went along in the morning, of course. I was young, myself and another lad, and even Murray, we went over as far as the cottages where the boats came ashore.
Yeah.
We seen the boats there, and their nets piled up on the strand, and fishing them. And I don't remember, that was the first dead man I ever seen, was Johnny Clone from Rossadilisk. He was later in a common cart now, in a kind shed in his Irish skins as he was taken on the strand, you know. They just put him on a common cart and wheeled him back.
It continued for 3 or 4 days. And there's this wonderful description given by people of, you know, with storm lanterns, they walk these beaches. Because although in the first day or so after, they did find some of the bodies, it took a week nearly for them to find others. So the entire community spent every night searching with these storm lanterns, these paraffin lamps, walking along the place, you know. So this is why the tragedy stays in the mind of people so long, because it was a week of tragedy. And then the most extraordinary thing in Cleggan is that, as you'll see, the church in Cleggan looks out on Omi Island, and the graveyard is on Omi Island. So what they do, they brought these bodies in the coffins, they put them in the parish hall beside the church. Then when they had the funeral service over, they carried them on their shoulders, you know, down from the church to Omi Island, across the strand into the graveyard. So, I mean, the visual pictures that creates just, you know, just reinforce the tragedy, you know, on people, I think.
In a common grave that was dug in the sand dunes, close to high water mark, but leagues from low springs, they laid side by side the pinewood coffins, lowering them on ropes, then shoveled the fine sand which whisperingly slid round their recent companions. And sometimes the shovels met with a knelling clang while in shifts they worked till the mound was raised.
I remember going fishing with him on a few occasions, but not too many. He was a tough old man, you know. He was tough, but easy going, you know. He wasn't a troublesome man by any means. Older men in the village used to call to visit him and talk to him about fishing and about, you know, what was going on and how the fishing was and that type of thing. And I used to hear them here in the house. Life had to go on. He had to rear us and make a living from the sea, you know. He had to continue. The stress couldn't come into it. He fished actually till he got blind to cataracts. And he was too late when he went to do something about them. He was too old.
The croak of a herring gull tolled across the sky. An oyster catcher squealed. Shoals broke on the bay. The flood tide rose and covered the deserted strand.